So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with The Modern Man. This week's episode is about sleep. It's not normally a good thing to say as a broadcaster. Listen to my podcast if you have trouble sleeping. but my guest today is a sleep doctor, an insomnia expert, which is fascinating, I think, whether you personally suffer from insomnia or not. A couple of things to update you on before we get going, though. A few of you have been in touch to ask what happened to Daniel Pike. Daniel is the guy I interviewed at the end of season 2 in the episode The Man Who Lives in the Woods. Over the summer, I'm afraid to report, he was forcibly evicted from his home, which he built, which was an astonishing place, but it was on Woodland Trust land. He was arrested. The good update, according to a YouTube video that he released last month, is he's making a go of reintegrating into society, and it's going okay. He's moved back in with his mum, he's got his old job back, and he is in love. So, Daniel, all the best from all of us. It was a privilege to come and see what you built. I hope you have a happier life out of the woods this time round. Some other news relating to season 1 of the show. You might recall episode 8, which was called Gambling Nearly Killed Me. I met an anti-gambling campaigner called Matt, whose life was ruined through addiction to fixed odds betting terminals in bookmakers. That completely changed my mind about how important it is to regulate those machines. Well, the good news is it looks like change may finally be on its way. The UK government is conducting a review to consider whether the current maximum stake of £100, which you can spend in seconds, is acceptable, or whether that should be reduced to stop exploiting vulnerable people. So fingers crossed. I mean, I fail to see how that report cannot conclude there needs to be more regulation there. But if you are one of the young men who wrote to me after that episode to say, this has affected me, Ollie, I am living proof of the damaging effect of those machines, don't write to me, write to the government. Tell them, because they're calling for evidence. I've shared the link on my Facebook page, facebook.com/Ollie Mann. Right, in this episode, you're going to learn how cloves can be used to spice up your love life, why your tablet computer may be ruining your mental health, potentially, and exactly how many minutes are in the master clock in your super charismatic nucleus, and what the fuck that means. Let's go! On this week's Modern Man.
Our brain is beginning to register that it's getting dark, it's meant to be moving us towards sleep, and then we go and stick a mini sun in our face.
Why technology isn't the answer to getting a good night's sleep.
But Mistress Magpie said clove cigarettes can work for some people.
And Alex Fox has a smoking question of sex in the foxhole. But first, it's all the stories you missed this week because you're far too important with Ollie Pitt. Hello, Ollie.
Hi, Ollie. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. What are the stories we should all be discussing this week?
CJ.
Okay.
Damui.
Oh, not cranberry juice.
Have you heard of CJ Damui?
I haven't.
He is a professional quizzer, and he's best known for Eggheads. Have you ever seen that show, Eggheads?
Okay, so that's the BBC One, is it? Daytime quiz show?
Yeah, I think so. And with Dermot Moynihan. Well, it was him. Yeah. And then I think it's Jeremy Vine now.
Like a panel of expert quizzers.
And he was one of the experts. And he was a professional quizzer. He actually entered loads of quizzes in 2000, including 15 to 1, Countdown, The Weakest Link, where he went completely mental after losing and had a little bit of a, went on a bit of a tirade. 100%, never even seen that show. Beat the Nation.
Okay, we get the idea.
Yeah, him.
Into his quizzes.
He thought his life was interesting enough to write an autobiography.
Okay.
And he described his early life, and he had a terrible childhood. And then he ran away from home and was homeless for a bit. But he ran away to Holland. Anyway, He also details an incident that happened to him in 1988, where he got into an altercation with a mugger. And he said, "He caught me on the wrong day and I just snapped. I knocked the knife out of the mugger's hand and threw him into the canal. I fully suspect I killed him. I have no idea what happened to him."
What?
Yeah. I fully suspect I killed him. I have no idea what happened to him.
By the by, in an anecdote like
that. In a book.
That's a weird dinner party chat, isn't it?
Anyway, the Dutch police, they found out and they issued a European arrest warrant for him.
Yeah.
In 1988, they actually found 12 bodies in that canal. I mean, most of them probably fell in. But the fact that he said in that year, he threw someone in there.
Okay. So the guy from Eggheads is now facing international justice.
Well, the court in Britain has said, no, there's not enough evidence to extradite him. So for now, he's safe. But there's a bigger issue, Ollie. You see that? That could be you and me, couldn't it?
No.
Well, not to the same level.
There's no anecdote in which I could place the line, "I suspect I killed him."
No, but it's the giving away too much information in a public space because we have social media now, right?
Oh,
do you
I see.
Think people kind of, like, the most common one probably is whinging about your boss or work or whatever, where you kind of go, "Work is rubbish. I hate my boss. He is such..." And then you go into work the next
job.
Day and you lose your job.
Yeah.
And that has happened.
Yeah, I know.
Have you ever done anything like
that? The problem is sometimes just... by someone's provocative nature, but especially if they're trolling you, you sort of get the impression that it's okay to play foul and you forget they're a real person. I remember the very first show I ever did on LBC, a guy tweeted me and his handle was Adolf Fistia. he had a Twitter handle that was named after a notorious dictator and a sexual act that's quite aggressive, I think it's fair to say. And he tweeted me during the show constantly to say things like that. "Grow up, you namby-pamby liberal." And after about 3 hours of it, I couldn't handle it. It was 4 a.m. I was getting used to overnight work. I tweeted back, "Go fuck yourself." Because that's what I would do if I wasn't on the radio. And then he started getting really weird. He then tweeted me back saying, "I can't believe I've just been told to go fuck myself by an LBC presenter. I'll be writing to your bosses soon." I wrote back to Adolf Fistia and I said, "I'd assumed by your jolly name that you were prepared for Twitter fisticuffs. Sorry if you're having a sense of humour failure. Lol."
Bet that went down well.
Actually, he backed off a bit. Like, he went, "Okay, well, just watch your language." Imagine that. Imagine Adolf Fistia writes to your boss first day in. All right, what else is going on this week, Ollie?
Zifferblatt.
Okay.
Basically, it's a cafe that's opened in Manchester. There's actually quite a few of them. And you pay by the minute. Basically, it's 6p a minute. You go in, you can have as much coffee, cakes.
Oh, it's eat all you like.
Eat all you like. And basically you sit in there and it's capped. There's a capped limit, which I went on their website to try and find out what the cap limit was. Don't know. Could be anything.
So it's 6p per minute.
6p per minute.
So just doing some quick maths on this now.
Yeah.
60 minutes in an hour.
6 times 60, which is...
360?
360, so £3.60 an hour.
£3.60 an hour, is that right?
Yes, okay. That sounds right.
That's quite a good deal then, isn't it? If you're
that's
there for
cheap.
An hour, two croissants and a coffee, £3.60.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And I'd imagine most people sort of use it as an office space. That's kind of the idea. So it stemmed from this, the original concept was a treehouse in Moscow. And they basically used to all meet up these guys and like write poems and that. It was to improve their poetry and stuff. And then they thought, well, you know, we need to pay for this space. So they did like a subscription thing and then it was pay as you go.
Uh-huh.
I've thought about some places that you could apply it as well, where I think that it worked really well. One of them is petrol stations, because people take ages in petrol stations. So you pay for your fuel, obviously, but then you pay by the minute when you're in there. So people go in, pay and get out. Do you like that one?
No.
That's good. What? Why is
no,
that not good?
Because it completely misunderstands the economics of running a petrol station, doesn't it? Because they're actually not making any profit out of the fuel, really. They're making money by selling you bagels.
Since when were you a petrol station magnate?
I've actually been through the indignity of interviewing a petrol station owner at length on local radio.
They don't make money on the petrol?
Not really, no.
So when I go in and I don't buy a pack of
that's
Quavers,
why
they're not making any money?
Yeah, exactly. That's why they've all got like Costa Coffee in there now. And you
that's
know.
Why Flapjack's £3.80.
Exactly.
Right.
It's like the cinemas don't really make money out of the films, they make money out of the popcorn. I've got a Dragon's Den idea of my own.
Is it based on pay by the minute?
No.
Go on.
But it's just it's an idea that occurred to me the other day and I thought, yeah, why doesn't that exist?
Mm.
Ready? Flavoured ice cubes.
Yeah, okay, that exists.
Does it?
Well, yeah, of course it does.
Where?
In my freezer. Just cordial. What are you doing? Just make your own.
You do that. You make handmade cordial flavoured ice cubes.
Oh my God.
And you say it's like a normal thing that everyone
there
does.
Literally everybody listening is going, what an idiot. Everybody does that in the summer. You're being serious.
What do you do with your cordial ice cubes? You put them in beers.
You make cordial.
Yeah.
And then you
You put it in an ice cube, yes, I understand. Then what do you do with the ice cubes?
No, put them in water, put them in drinks, lemonade.
No, never done that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. You're actually just underlining the fact that there is a market out there. I was going to say for chumps like you, but if you're making your own, fine. I think chumps like you who shop in Waitrose, who would be prepared to spend, let's say, £2.50 on a pack of 10, right? It's ice, it costs nothing, high profit margins. I think with an advertising campaign telling people to put a lime cordial ice cube in a jar of Coke, you would make an absolute fortune. You can have that for free, listeners, because I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to make flavoured ice cubes because life is short and one day I'll die.
Or any money.
What's your final trend of the week, Ollie Pitt?
Vine.
Well, it's over.
Yeah, it's dead.
What is Vine? Remind us.
So Vine is an app, a video app, that loops 6-second videos.
Yes.
Basically, you can do like stop motion animation on it. Basically, it only records when you touch the screen, so you can do like, you can edit on the fly and all this kind of stuff. It launched in, what was it, 2012?
I remember those halcyon days.
Something like that. Yeah, God, it's
when
so long ago.
On social network felt novel.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it did really, really well. You know, they got loads of people got involved in it. And I think at one point it was the biggest video platform on the internet for a very short time. Mm-hmm. Twitter has axed it. They bought it for 30 million, like 3 months after it launched.
I'm going to have my flavoured ice cube cover. 3 million.
They're going to need it, I think. Anyway, it's dead. I think actually Vine's user base was dropping and views were dropping.
Also, you can't really use Vine for porn. And I think any video sharing platform on the internet that can't really be used for pornography isn't going to last. Tumblr, they've managed to make it so you can, I don't know how long a Tumblr video can be, but it's like 2 minutes or something. Long enough for a porn clip, isn't it?
It's
6 seconds, you know, even if your appetite is insatiable, is a little bit brief.
It's very interesting you say that because Pornhub have formally put a bid in for Vine.
Have they?
Yes.
Right. I can't believe you're returning to this trope. Long-term listeners of the show will remember a period where every week Ollie came in with a story about Pornhub to justify his insane consumption of that site.
It was... It's not insane. It's just average.
Do you constantly say to your girlfriend, it's like, no, it's fine, I'm just reading the press releases. It's for work.
But yeah, 6-second porn clips, that's exactly what they're going to do.
Really?
I mean, that's not long enough,
No,
is
it's
it?
Not long enough, no.
Unless you loop it over. And I don't know which
Well, Vines do loop over, but I still think... Yeah, let's not get graphic. That's for at the end of the show. Ollie Pitt, thank you. That passed the time. If people want to suggest a trend for next week, what should they do?
At The Modern Man on Twitter.
On Twitter, whilst it still exists, whilst the business model still survives.
Yes.
Now, how many hours sleep do you get each night? And by that, I don't mean how many hours are there between you putting your head on the pillow, turning out the light, and the moment your alarm goes off the next morning. I am actually asking, how many hours do you estimate you are properly asleep? Because I find it very, very hard to say. I regularly spend, an hour or so, regularly, looking up at the ceiling, tossing and turning, perhaps unable to get back to sleep after being woken up. And 30% of the UK population will at some point experience insomnia. So I wanted to talk to the preeminent British scientist in this, in most sleep disorders actually, a guy called Dr. Guy Meadows. I met him to get some tips on how to cure insomnia, but I discovered his particular interest with sleeplessness came from a personal experience.
So one of the reasons why I got into insomnia is because when I was at the sleep research laboratories, I was having to do nights. And for anyone, any of the listeners who knows what it's like to do shift work, they'll know that it can be incredibly disruptive on your sleep-wake cycle. And it becomes, you know, a common problem with that is insomnia. And so I began to, as a result of doing sleep research, but got my first bout of insomnia.
And what time were you trying to go to sleep then? Sort of 6 a.m. or something?
We'd normally finish testing at about 6. We'd get home at about 8 or 9, something like that. And then you're trying to sleep at that peak time when your brain is desperately trying to wake you up, you know.
And did you try all the stuff, the blackout curtains?
Yeah, exactly.
Eating at different times.
You do all of the, you know, all of the standard advice where you wind down as best you can. You put a note on the door so the postman doesn't bother you. Yeah. You know, you tell your partner, your neighbours, everyone not to disturb you, etc. The problem is you're fighting against the biological processes. Your internal body clock is basically all of the signals are saying, hey, it's daytime, we need to be awake, you know, and you're there, you are trying to sleep. So that was the initial sort of challenge to my sleep. And then I started to work in insomnia. So every day I was seeing people who couldn't sleep. And so naturally I put my head on the pillow one day and my brain went, what if you don't sleep?
Yeah.
And that was actually what led me to pioneering the approach that I'm doing, because what I noticed is I started to, my instant knee-jerk reaction was, don't think about it, of course, which meant I thought about it more. And my instant, I tried to fix it. You know, I started trying to do lots of things like I was telling people to do. And what I realized is actually the more I was doing, the further away it went. And so that was a light bulb moment, along with the fact that so many of my clients were coming to me and they would say, Guy, I was awake all night. You know, I was struggling with sleep. It got to 6 a.m. I knew I had to be up at 7 and I fell asleep. And I was like, well, what happened at 6 a.m.? And they said, well, you know, I went, sod it. You know, the night's ruined. And of course, they fell asleep. And I thought, wow, isn't it amazing, you know, how they learned to let go at that moment.
So when people come to you, I presume, often with respect, is a bit of a last resort. That their first attempt will have been, you know, Googling stuff. Then they maybe have gone to see their GP. Then maybe they've bought a book or downloaded some hypnotherapy off the internet. When they get to you, they're coming to you and saying, none of that stuff works, help me.
Exactly. So my sort of tagline, which I developed nearly a decade ago, was that as I was sort of working with this, I suddenly realized, hang on, if you ask a normal sleeper what they do to sleep, they'll tell you they do absolutely nothing. But if you ask an insomniac, they'll give you a list as long as their arm. Mm. That's actually part of the problem. It's almost like the controlling aspect of being human, which is fantastic. You know, if your phone breaks, you find, you know, someone to fix it or get a new one. You know, we are able to build houses, book train tickets, etc. And so why not, when we can't sleep, why not just try and solve it in the same way? So we get busy. You know, we start going on the internet, as you say. We stop drinking caffeine, we stop drinking alcohol, we start running marathons. But then we start going, hang on, I'm doing all of these so-called things right. Why am I not sleeping? And that actually generates its own anxiety, sleep anxiety, which keeps us awake even more.
I mean, I suppose in extreme cases, that leads to drug addiction, doesn't it? I mean, you think of Michael Jackson when you talk about this stuff, and he's taking Demerol and propofol to go to sleep. I mean, is that uncommon? I mean, obviously, like, that kind of industrial strength might be, but...
Sadly, it's not. And that's all part of the sort of the desperation that builds up for my clients. People become so desperate just to get to some sleep, they will use anything. And so we know that 83% of the people who come to see us are taking some form of pill, whether that be a prescribed medication, most sort of commonly the Z drugs like Zolpidem and Zopiclone, or it might be some of the older drugs like the benzodiazepines, diazepam, etc. It could be some of the antihistamines, which you can, you know, sort of like Pirtan, or you get some sort of cold and flu remedy, or it could be some herbal over-the-counter remedy. And then they might throw in a little bit of alcohol as well. One of my clients who I always refer to is she came to me and she was lining up 6 shot glasses of vodka on a bedside table, you know, and it worked because it sort of knocked her out, but she realized, you know, it got to a stage where it was now a problem.
Yeah, she'd become an alcoholic, so she'd solved one problem and replaced it with another one.
Yeah, and that's why I always say the solutions effectively in the long term become the problem.
Okay, so your solutions basically are what?
The key thing that I've been pioneering is the use of something called acceptance and commitment therapy for insomnia. So ACT, as it's known, is a form of cognitive behavior therapy. It's a newer form. So there's lots of research for traditional CBTI, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, proving it to be effective. But its treatment effect is about 50%. So my point was that I wanted to do a therapy which was going to be more effective. And that's where I discovered this ACT therapy. I guess the easiest way to describe the difference is CBT is very much control-based. It's very much symptom reduction-based. So the aim is, what can we do to get rid of the thoughts and the emotions and the insomnia? And that makes perfect sense. However, you ask any insomniac or anyone, if they've had a racing mind in the middle of the night and they tried to get rid of the thoughts or block them out, what happened? They'll often tell you, well, that it didn't work. You know, the thoughts came back in stronger and they brought their friends in with them as well. You know, and if they try to sort of deep breathe away their anxiety, again, it may sort of work for a little bit, but often it comes back. And what ACT discovered, well, actually, it's often the struggle to get rid of the symptoms, the thoughts, the emotions and the insomnia, which actually keeps it fueled. It keeps it alive. And so what ACT seeks to do is change the way you relate to it. And this is the sort of the groundbreaking new approach, which ACT is 31 years old. It's got 105 randomized controlled trials, proving it to be effective from everything from chronic depression to generalized anxiety disorder, substance abuse, post-traumatic stress, chronic pain.
It's essentially saying, I accept that I'm going to struggle to get to sleep tonight. I accept that, you know, these thoughts are racing through my head, but But then what? So what? What do you do then?
So it's not just, you know, I accept that I'm insomniac, therefore, you know, end of. So what we seek to do is employ processes such as mindfulness and other ones called cognitive diffusion. And what they are enabling you to do is to be able to, rather than trying to get rid of the thoughts and emotions, be able to shift your perspective on them, to become much more of an observer of them, so that you can witness that you're experiencing them, but you are open to having them. And the point there is you've suddenly gone from sort of a state of battling and struggle to a state of sort of acceptance and therefore unwillingness to experience them. So in the middle of the night, I might teach someone, rather than, say, having to get out of bed, which is a typical CBT rule might be, if you've been awake for more than 15 minutes, get out of bed and go and do something else. So we actually teach people to stay in bed and learn how not to struggle with the emotions, how to save their energy, because you get a lot of benefit from just resting in bed. And crucially, by doing that, what you're doing is you're changing the way your brain relates to the night. Because more often than not, what we find is that as a result of many nights of struggling, the brain begins to associate the nighttime with wakefulness, and hence why it wakes you up.
And if your symptoms aren't that extreme, but you're listening to this and then, you know, you go to bed tonight and you find yourself, as I did last night, just awake for what feels like 2 or 3 hours, and you don't want to be. And it's not something that happens every night, it's something that happens occasionally. What is the best thing to be thinking?
The things that the listeners should know is that it's perfectly normal to wake in the night. So we have we sleep in cycles, which are 1.5 to 2 hours long. So every 1.5 to 2 hours, we have a natural awakening. And in that mode, I would just ask you to focus your attention onto something in the present moment. So that could be just the rise and fall of your breath. It could be the sense of touch between you and the actual bed. You know, sort of what you can feel. I can feel the duvet on my toes. I can feel the pillow under my head. And you're using that as a sort of a grounding, or a sort of like an anchor for your mind, which you would focus upon. And then if your mind wanders off, which, you know, suddenly it goes, what about that podcast, or what about my, you know, shopping or my to-do list, each time it does that, you just thank it. You go, okay, thanks, thinking mind, that's great, you know, thanks for that thought, but I'm just going to come back. You might find that quite hard at first, but what we actually know is, with a little bit of practice, it becomes, you start to strengthen the letting go muscle, which is your prefrontal cortex area, part of your brain. And actually, if you do 10 minutes of that exercise, so it's a mindful breathing exercise a day for 8 weeks, and if we scanned your brain now and we scanned your brain at the end of 8 weeks, what we'd know is that the prefrontal cortex actually expands.
And no way.
Yep.
You change the shape of your brain.
You actually alter the structure of your brain, yeah.
By thinking in the moment.
By being in the moment, yeah. So this is one of the most amazing things about modern science, is we now have neuroscience. So whenever we are engaging in any sort of, you know, sort of therapy, we can now look at whether it, you know, actually has a change at a structural level. And
this isn't just sort of electrodes are more weighed towards one side of the brain than the other. This is the actual physical outline of your brain in an X-ray has changed.
This is actually the volume of your brain, yeah.
That's fucking nuts.
So what
in how many weeks? 3 weeks?
In 8 weeks.
8 weeks.
But actually, there was a study recently where they were doing 20 minutes a day and they saw structural changes. I think it was in 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay, so if you're awake tonight for 2 hours and you try and think in the moment, at least consider that it's a brain workout.
Exactly. And you know, I'm really pleased you called it like that, because we are all aware of the concept of, you know, going down the gym. If we went down the gym and did 10 minutes of, you know, bicep curls for 8 weeks, we'd get bigger biceps. Well, we now know that mental training works exactly the same. The brain is effectively a muscle, and you can train that letting go muscle. And it's the great thing about the prefrontal cortex is that it's responsible for focused attention. It manages our mood. It helps us to problem solve. It helps us to be rational. And so actually, you know, this is incredibly helpful for all areas of life, let alone actually just reducing our arousal level, helping us to manage our thoughts and fall back off to sleep.
I've read a lot of theories that say, essentially, the bedroom should just be for sleep and sex, and that's it. And if you're reading a book in bed, even, you are stimulating your brain, when really, that should be a place you go to sleep.
On that rule you've heard there, I completely disagree with. So that's a strong sort of CBT rule, which is that the bedroom is only for sleep and sex. And I get lots of clients coming to me and they're going, but, you know, I really enjoy reading and, you know, I want to be a normal sleeper. And my issue is I want to help people become normal sleepers. And normal sleepers means having a normal, relaxed relationship with your bedroom, which if that means, you know, sort of chatting with your partner, reading a nice book, then I would highly encourage that. However, there is a line in the sand. And in recent years, we've seen a rapid increase in the amount of light stimulation that we're receiving from all of the light emitting devices. You know, suddenly when I go and do my corporate workshops, I'll ask how many of you are checking your mobiles in the last sort of, you know, sort of while sat in bed, and, you know, sort of three quarters of the hands will go up. It's just, it's what we all do now. And we'll be checking Facebook and Twitter, etc. And so the line between sort of day and night has become blurred.
Why is that a problem in particular? Is it the light actually being emitted from the device, or is it to do with the stimulation of interacting with people on social media, or is it the two together?
It's both. So to put it into context, so we've got an internal body clock, 20,000 cells located just behind our eyes. It's an area, it's our master clock in an area called our suprachiasmatic nucleus. And that's responsible for sleep and wake. It's responsible for regulating our temperature, hormones, you know, sort of appetite hormones, etc. Pretty much everything. And that's kept on a time of 24 hours and 7 minutes, okay? Now, that clock is kept on time by the rise and fall of the sun, so light and dark. So we have these 500 million year old light sensitive cells in our eyes, which right now as we're sat in this studio are detecting the light coming through that window, and they're telling us what time it is. And as a result of that, that will be telling the body to initiate lots of biological reactions, which as it gets dark, that tells the body to inhibit cortisol and start releasing melatonin, the sleep promoting hormone. So here we have the issue that our brain is beginning to register that it's getting dark, it's to be releasing melatonin, moving us towards sleep. And then in our infinite wisdom, we go and stick a mini sun in our face. And that's,
so the brain really does treat it like you're looking outside out of a window. That's
exactly,
your reaction to it.
Exactly, because the light, the wavelength of the light, it's called blue light because it's the same wavelength as blue sky or sunlight. It's 365 nanometers, and it's the most stimulating to those light-sensitive cells. So effectively, we know it switches off melatonin production or reduces it and delays sleep onset and reduces sleep quality.
So listening to the radio, reading a Kindle, you know, that's got the technology where it looks like paper, that all of that's better than using an iPad, basically.
Exactly. There was a lovely study done a couple of years ago where they investigated someone reading off an iPad before bed for an hour compared reading a print book with a typical bedside lamp, which is much more of an orange light, which is less stimulating. And what they found is that melatonin production was greatly reduced as a result of the light stimulation from the iPad, and sleep onset was delayed and sleep quality was reduced. Ideally, if you can switch off all of those devices at least 30 minutes before going to bed, then that will really help, because it just helps to signal to the brain, hey, sleep's on its way, let's go for it. But there are now lots of blue light filters coming out. So for example, you know, most Apple devices, if you swish up from the bottom, you'll see something called night mode, where you can click on that and the screen goes orange, and you can set it so all my devices will go orange from 7 p.m. and they go blue again, the normal light, from 6 a.m.
And that has a real scientific basis, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's just filtering out.
And you use that?
And I yeah, absolutely.
So even in the summer when it's light outside?
Yep.
You set your device on night mode from 7 p.m.
Because what you've got to recognise is the light, the wavelength of the light outside. Let's say it's a summer's evening and it's, you know, sort of 9 or 10 p.m. at night. Yeah. The wavelength of that light is still actually much more orange than, say, the sort of the set blue light that's been emitted from your phone.
And let's talk hours then, because this is another preoccupation, isn't it, of those who want to sleep well to improve their health or have a problem sleeping.
Yeah.
They talk about how many hours are you getting. Standard advice is 8 hours a night, right? Is that right?
Yeah, standard advice is 7 to 8 hours. So we know that the average, you know, the majority of the population is sort of 85%, etc., will need, as a result of their sort of genetics, will need around 7 to 8 hours.
So does that mean that there are, since it's an average, some people who only need 4 hours a night?
Absolutely. So we know that as a result of our genetics, a tiny percentage, you know, 0.001% will need as little as 4. And some people will need as much as 12.
Well, you see, that's what I was coming on to. If you're one of those unfortunate people who needs 10, chances are in the modern world, you're not getting 10 ever.
No, exactly.
You know, maybe one Saturday in 4, you're getting 10.
Yeah.
So what does that do to your health?
You know, in the short term, lack of sleep basically reduces our ability to be focused, to be attentive, to recall memory, to increase our risk of accidents, etc. But in the long term, we know that it plays an important role in our managing our weight, managing our blood glucose levels, keeping our hearts healthy, our blood pressure healthy, and also our mental health, you know, sort of reducing our risk of depression and anxiety.
I've got a friend who swears by napping and says he takes two a day and they're half an hour each and he feels brilliant after each one and I should try it. And I've tried it and I feel dreadful after half an hour lying down.
Okay, so when it comes to napping, you know, I'm a huge fan of it. I do a lot of it myself. And
how much?
I will, if I can, I will, you know, nap 2 to 3 times a week.
Right. What, like an hour?
No. And this is where I think, you know, perhaps you were going a little bit wrong.
Uh-huh.
So, and it's, you know, napping is an individual thing again. But what we know as a rule of thumb, the ideal time for napping is between 10 and 20 minutes. Start going up to sort of 30, certainly beyond 30, and you run the risk of going into deeper sleep.
Yeah, but that's what I want. I wake up thinking, oh, I didn't have deep sleep. I'm just...
But the problem with...
10 minutes lying on a bed, nothing's going to happen. I'm just going to be thinking. Is that napping?
So you can train yourself to nap.
Okay.
So I spent about 6 months training myself to nap. So basically meant I'd fall asleep in a minute and wake myself up naturally up after 10 minutes.
Wow.
But it takes...
That's like Britain's Got Talent level stuff.
But the problem, it took a lot of work.
Yeah.
And most people don't nap because they go, well, you know, I won't fall asleep, so... I won't do it. Most often than not, when we're in light sleep, we don't even know whether we're asleep or not. So don't let that be a barrier to you. I would say allow yourself 20 minutes. Take sleep off the menu. You know, sort of just use it as an opportunity to be still and rest.
Mm.
And if you fall asleep, you know, hopefully you've set an alarm, etc. You don't want to be going beyond 30 minutes because then you go into brain fog territory because you're waking up out of deep sleep and you'll be useless to everyone. So...
Okay, so 20 minutes, what time of day is best for napping?
Ideal between 12 and 3, because that's when we have a natural dip in the waking signal produced by the body clock.
Okay, 12 till 3, just try lying down for 10 minutes. Take sleep off the menu.
Exactly.
Okay, I'll give it a go. Dr. Guy Meadows there. And if you want to find out more about him or his book or his insomnia school, head on down to thesleepschool.org. Man fans, this podcast is free to download, but it isn't free to produce. We're making this off our own backs. We don't have big corporate backers with deep pockets. The only money we're getting in is what you can hear in advertising and sponsorship and listener donations. So if you enjoy the show and you'd like us to make even more episodes, my goal one day is to be weekly all year round. Then why not buy us a beer to say thank you? The average cost of a pint of beer in Britain is £3.31. You can sign up on our website using a secure credit card payment to buy us one beer every month. Or you can just treat us to a one-off pint or two. Visit modernman.co.uk, click beer money, and if we ever meet, the next one's on me. Thanks. I'm too sexy for this section. Yes, it's the Foxhole, where we talk about sex, baby, with our resident love guru, Alex Fox. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Ollie Man. How are you, my love?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, we bring you this section thanks to the lovely chaps at mycondom.com. Alex, remind us of their wonderful service.
They sell a whole massive variety of condoms that you can buy individually, so you can try them out before you buy tons of them, including quite rare varieties like the Skins Black Chocolate, which is one of my favourites, because not only does it smell and taste of chocolate, but it's actually black. So if you're a bit kinky and into S&M, then you can coordinate your condom with your other love objects.
Good stuff. Let's move on to talk about this week's sex question. It is from someone who is choosing to be known only as H. I don't know if it's the bloke from Steps or not. They say, my boyfriend has a smoking fetish. We've been together for a few years and I'm happy to indulge his fetish, but I'm worried about the health connotations of smoking cigars. That's interesting, isn't it, that it's cigars? I mean, I just went immediately for cigarettes, but I guess maybe pipes, but cigars... I suppose they're more insertable, aren't they, cigars?
They're a bit thicker, so yeah. if it's that oral fixation that turns you on, that kind of idea of something phallic being inserted between someone's lips, then yes. But also cigars are associated with power and richness, aren't they?
Yeah.
So if you're somebody who's submissive and is turned on by a woman smoking who's in a position of dominance, then the accoutrements of dominance and richness, like cigars, might be might add an extra layer of excitement for
you. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, when I sort of read smoking fetish, I was immediately thinking people who just like having smoke blown in their face or whatever. But
that can be part of it. It's multi-layered.
I don't inhale the smoke, says H. I used to, but it kept making me nauseous. But I know there are still dangers involved with regular cigar smoking. So, Alex, are there any alternatives to turn him on that aren't so bad for me?
Okay, first up, I have to be absolutely clear. Even though H isn't inhaling the smoke from these cigars, any smoke going into your mouth is still a risk. It can give you mouth cancer over the long term. However, that's a calculated risk. If H isn't doing this very often, then it's probably not a major problem. But I wouldn't be a responsible advisor if I didn't point out that it isn't ideal to be smoking in any context.
Sure, but therefore, I guess what this question hints at actually is, you know, rather like with actors on stage, it's such a common problem that characters have to smoke in plays and enough actors don't smoke anymore that there are now stage cigarettes you can buy. In fact, since they introduced all these laws stopping smoking indoors, you have to use those, I think.
Well, that's one of my suggestions, actually.
Actor cigarettes.
You can buy really convincing actor cigarettes that pose no health risk whatsoever.
But there aren't special sex cigarettes. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, what, for smoking fetishists?
Yeah, I sound like Alan Partridge now, don't I?
Sex cigarettes. Sex cigarettes, I'm sure they exist somewhere, but I doubt they are for smoking. They sound like some kind of buzzing toy, don't they? Now, I have a lot of friends who work as dominatrixes and doms, and a lot of them produce smoking fetish videos or have clients that come to them to indulge smoking fetishes. So I actually asked a few of my kinky pals what their ideas were on this. And they've come up with some stunning suggestions. One of my mates, Master Dominic, said it probably doesn't hit the spot as much, but vaping is an option. In fact, vaping fetish is becoming a new genre of indulgence for a lot of people. There are vaping fetish videos.
More flavours.
Yeah, more flavours. And also, though, some of those really heavy-duty vape machines can produce a lot of smoke. So if it's the visual of someone exhaling a big billowing cloud of smoke that gets you off, or breathing that directly in your face,
yeah,
then vaping can still do the trick.
I'd so never thought of, like, option. Connection between... Because maybe people with, like, dry ice machines have really serious smoking fetishes. You know, maybe Andrew Lloyd Webber, when he came up with that whole Phantom of the Opera thing,
yeah.
You know. Maybe that was just a giant smoking fetish.
Or maybe he's got a fog fetish. I can see why a fog fetish would be a thing, actually.
I can see.
You don't know who's approaching you from out of the smog.
I can see Lloyd Webber and Brightman romping in the fog, can't you? I wouldn't be surprised.
He also says he favours cigars because they produce big plumes of smoke. They're less damaging if you stub them out on somebody, if someone's into pain. Because cigars have a wider surface area, they actually burn less and produce less of an injury. Other options, Mistress Magpie, another one of my mates, said that clove cigars...
How many dominatrixes did you write to for this?
I just put it on Facebook and they all came forth.
I mean...
This is the company I keep.
This is well
researched. And they're brilliant people. They're superb people. Mistress Magpie said clove cigarettes can work for some people. And
Where do you get yourself a clove cigarette?
Google.
It sounds like something, you know, when we were 12 years old and people were trying cigarettes for the first time, people were like, yeah, don't go straight for the Marlboro, just go to Sainsbury's, buy yourself some cloves, roll them up.
I don't know. I think it sounds like someone with heavily embroidered Indian trousers and a fetish for dream catchers might be into, you know.
Both works.
All of these things, unfortunately, may not quite satisfy H's partner's fetish, because for some fetishists, the very idea that the cigarette or the cigar is naughty and bad and dangerous is the very turn on itself. Mm. The fetish can rely very specifically on the exact smell of the cigar. You know, it's the whole aesthetics and psychological aspects of the experience can be really tied in very tightly to whether it turns the fetishist on or not. So although I would encourage H to try these different healthier options, they may not hit the spot for their partner. So H might have to make a measured decision. Do they indulge now and again in their partner's fetish, even though they're not massive fans of cigars? Or do they switch to something that's maybe not so bad for their lungs?
Yeah, and when you mention danger, of course, you know, I think if you are having sex in a bed, that's something to bear in mind.
Yeah, please
as well,
don't set
it?
Yourself on fire.
Yeah. Maybe that's what Kings of Leon was singing
night.
About.
Yeah.
All of which brings us to an end for this week's Foxhole. Thanks again to mycondom.com for sponsoring this section of the show. And remember, you can get 15% off any of their wonderful products by using the code
Foxhole! Foxhole!
And if you have a question of sex for next week's show, Alex, what should you do with it?
You should tootle on over to our website, which is modernmann.co.uk. Click on feedback and send me your query.
And with that, this week's Modern Man is nearly at an end, but we do have a new Manbassador. It is JWCW123, who has posted us a review at itunes.com/MAN. He says, working in Germany, I'm subjected to trashy Europop and senseless adverts. Your podcast is literally the only thing preventing me from German radio-induced suicide. Thank you, JWCW123. You're obviously a hard man to please. I note that you gave the All 4 app by Channel 4 just one star. Harsh. JWCW123, I am honoured to knight you our new Manbassador for Germany. Our theme is by Django Django from their first album, and here's a song to flush out your ear canal. It's the new one by Dan Kroll. It's called Swim, and it's out now on Communion Records. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and we'll see you next Tuesday.